And I'm back to read Hitler's War by David Irving. Hess and Bormann. As a German and as a soldier, I consider it beneath me ever to belittle a brave enemy, exclaimed Hitler to his assembled Reichstag deputies on May 4th, 1941. But it seems necessary to me to do something to protect the truth from the boastful lies of a man who is as miserable a politician as he is a soldier, and is as wretched a soldier as he is a politician. Hitler was declaiming on the Wehrmacht's fresh Balkan triumph. Just as he did after Norway and Dunkirk, Mr. Churchill, he also began this campaign, is trying to say something that he might yet be able to twist and distort into a British victory. Mr. Churchill may be able to lay down a smokescreen for his fellow countrymen, but he cannot eliminate the results of his disasters. Now the brave Greek people had paid for their pro-British monarch's folly. I regret it from the start. For me, as a German, born and bred to revere and respect the art and culture of this country once the first rays of mortal beauty and dignity emerged, it was a hard and bitter experience to see this happening and be able to do nothing to prevent it. From the French and British documents found in France, he said he had realized how far the Greek government had drifted into Britain's arms. Rudolf Hess sat between Hitler and Ribbentrop throughout this Reichstag speech. Ribbentrop later said that Hess's eyes looked completely abnormal all evening. Constitutionally, deputy Führer of the party since April 1933 and second in line of succession after Goering, Hess was an eccentric. Just how eccentric we now know from the recently recovered Gestapo interrogations of his private staff. Criminal rat Franz Lutz, his detective, would describe in detail the plethora of doctors, therapists, dowsers, magnetopaths, hypnotists, and masseurs with a distaste evidently born of his boss's requirement that each of these dubious medical practitioners first test their methods on his staff. Hess had been born in British Egypt and was unabashedly pro-British, a pacifist and an idealist. According to his secretary, Hess spoke privately with him at the end of this Reichstag speech, but merely inquired whether the Führer still stood by the program he had set forth in Mein Kampf, of marching side by side with Britain. Hitler had nodded. He claimed to have attached no importance to this inquiry. Very shortly after the speech at 8:15 that evening, May 4, 1941, he left Berlin by train for the dockyard at Gotenhafen, on the Baltic, to inspect Raeder's new ships, the Bismarck and Tirpitz. The later Gestapo interrogations established that Hess's private audience with Hitler had occurred on May 3rd, the evening before the speech, and not on May 4th, and they put a rather different slant on it. Hess's adjutant Gunther Soroff related that on May 3rd, Hess had gone to Munich's Riem Airport to fly up to Berlin by government plane, and that 10 minutes before takeoff, Professor Karl Haushofer had come to speak with Hess. That Haushofer had thereafter asked the adjutant to stay behind and await a phone message from him to forward to Hess in Berlin, and that on that evening, May 3rd, Haushofer had phoned this message to Soroff to pass to the deputy Führer. On a scale of 1 to 6, things stand at around 3 or 4, and more needs doing. His son Albrecht, he added, would report as soon as he got back from Portugal. Hinch, who had mistrusted the younger Haushofer as a spongy half-Jew, and wondered why party headquarters allowed him to come and go the way he did, dutifully passed the cryptic message to Hess in Berlin. Hess had arrived in Berlin at 5:20 p.m. on May 3rd. He had ordered his staff to bring his brand new Luftwaffe Hauptmann's uniform with them, so he was certainly up to something. He knew that the younger Haushofer had left Germany to contact the anti-Churchill opposition. That evening, confirmed his detective later to Gestapo interrogators, Comrade Hess was with the Führer. The adjutant Pinch confirmed that upon receiving this important phone message from Haushofer, Hess had taken it straight over to the Führer. He added, I believe it was from Portugal. After talking with Hess, Hitler now made a crucial alteration to the text of his next day's speech to the Reichstag. What that was, we do not know. Hess's staff had been aware for some weeks that he was toying with the idea of flying to Scotland. Detective Lutz, torn by uncertainty over whether to report this to Himmler, asked Pinch the next day, the 4th, whether Hess had told the Führer of his intention. The adjutant replied that their boss had told him that, yes, he had now spoken with the Führer about his plan. The Führer was not averse to it, he had said. The last time that Hitler had seen Tirpitz was at her launching at Wilhelmshaven 2 years before. He still recalled the keen, honest features of the shipyard workers. A real aristocracy of the working class, he reminisced. The two new battleships dominated the dockyard. The Bismarck, with her 28,000 miles of electrical circuits and her radar-controlled guns, was the most advanced warship afloat. Indeed, the Navy considered her unsinkable, and Admiral Gunther Lütjens, the gaunt-faced fleet commander, emphasized this word to Hitler in his cabin. He reported on the brilliant marauding operation which he had commanded with the battleships Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, raiding Atlantic convoys bringing war supplies to Britain from the United States. When Hitler voiced qualms that Lütjens' proposal to risk the capital ships very soon against the Atlantic convoys, the admiral put his mind at rest. "Mein Führer," he said, "there is nothing that can go wrong for me with a ship like this. The only danger that I can see is torpedo aircraft coming at us from aircraft carriers." Hitler returned to Berlin. He again commented unhappily to Dr. Goebbels that the ruin that Mr. Churchill was wreaking on the British Empire and on Italy's series of military reverses. "Without them," he remarked, scoffing at the Italians, "Pétain would have stayed at our side, Franco might have joined us after all, and Gibraltar would be in our hands. Then Turkey would have been wide open to affairs, too." It just did not bear thinking about, Goebbels lamented, recording these remarks in his diary as Hitler continued south to Berchtesgaden, where he was to meet Darlin on May 11th. Briefly, Hitler turned his attention to Iraq. On April 2nd, a coup d'etat had brought the anti-British general Rashid Ali el-Gailani to power when the British thereupon landed in strength at the port of Basra on the Persian Gulf. Rashid Ali's small army encircled the British airbase at Habaniya, some 25 miles west of Baghdad, and fighting broke out. The Iraqis appealed to Germany for aid. German military experts were flown out, followed by a diminutive force of Messerschmitt and Heinkel aircraft, which Darlin allowed to land on the Vichy French airfields in Syria. That Saturday evening, May 10th, a bulky packet was delivered to the Berghof. Told it was from Hess, Hitler pushed it aside. Toward noon the next day, he was standing in the Berghof's great hall when there was a commotion. One of Hess's adjutants burst in. He handed Hitler a slim envelope. There were two pages inside. Hitler put on his eyeglasses and began to glance over them indifferently. Suddenly, he slumped into a chair and bellowed in a voice that could be heard all over the house, "Oh, my God! My God! He has flown to Britain!" Hess's adjutants confirmed that his chief had taken off at Augsburg Airfield at 5:40 p.m. The previous evening. Hitler rounded on Bodenschatz. "How is it, Herr General, that the Luftwaffe let Hess fly, although I forbade it? Goering, get Goering here!" He now found that the bulky packet from Hess contained a long-winded account of his motives for flying and of his proposed peace plan, apparently written on October 1940. Hess promised not to betray Barbarossa to the British. Bodenschatz telephoned Goering at his castle Weldenstein near Nuremberg. The Reichsmarshal petulantly asked why he was required at the Berghof. Hitler snatched the telephone, shouted, "Goering, you're to come at once!" and slammed the instrument down. The deputy Führer's adjutant, the bearer of ill tidings, was arrested and led away. A wave of hysterical speculation gripped the Berghof. "Every possible construction," wrote Schmutz's wife in her diary. Hitler confided to Julius Schaub what he feared. If Hess really gets If Hess really gets there, just imagine. Churchill has Hess in his grasp. What lunacy on Hess's part. They will give Hess some drug or other to make him stand before a microphone and broadcast whatever Churchill wants. Bodenschatz began immediate technical inquiries. Perhaps Hess might have crashed en route, or run into foul weather. Admiral Darlan, now Pétain's deputy premier, foreign minister, navy minister, and minister of the interior in one, arrived after lunch with Ribbentrop, but now that Hitler had decided on Barbarossa, his interest in the Mediterranean had waned, and his inborn mistrust of the French was not easily overcome. In the Yugoslav files captured in Belgrade, a document had been found indicating that General Weygand was preparing to transfer his allegiance to de Gaulle. Canaris was to note at this time, "When I turned to our obverse subversive operations in Syria and Iraq, the Field Marshal Keitel explained that the Führer is inclined to be skeptical about the French attitude over this issue, as he is indeed about their whole attitude toward collaborating with Germany. The chief of the OKW mentioned in passing a discussion on the subject of de Gaulle, in the course of which the Führer interrupted Ribbentrop, who had uttered a derogatory remark about de Gaulle. The words, "Now, now, my dear Ribbentrop, if you found yourself in the same situation, you would be the first to become a Gaullist." Since February, Ribbentrop had seriously flirted with the notion of winning over France to collaboration. The French should place their fleet at the Axis' disposal for the fight against Britain, and concede bases to Germany in French Africa. Hitler, however, remained skeptical and cool toward Darlan. A break for tea was taken at 5:30, but Huell noticed that the Führer's mind was elsewhere. Small wonder Hitler's mind was on Hess. The Reichsmarschall arrived at 9 p.m. Huell recorded that night, "A long discussion with the Führer downstairs in the hall. The Führer, Foreign Minister Göring Bormann, very irritable. Much speculation. Throughout this day and the next, the argument raged back and forth as to whether Hess had arrived in Britain or was by now dead. A very upset day," wrote Huell on the 12th. Göring and Odette believed Hess could not have managed the difficult flight to Glasgow. Führer thinks Hess could have pulled it off. It was Ribbentrop who sagely pointed out that if they waited any longer, the British might announce the news at any moment. Indeed, they could claim that Hess had brought an official offer for a separate peace. That would set the cat among the pigeons. Hitler was aghast. He ordered Ribbentrop to telephone reassurances to Ciano. The first investigations had meanwhile established that Hess had fallen under the sway of nature, healers, and astrologers. This facilitated the announcement that while Hess had evidently acted from idealistic motives, he was in fact quite mad. "The Führer decides to go ahead with the announcement," wrote Huell. "He insists on including the passage about it being the action of a madman." By late afternoon, the 10th redraft of the communique was complete. It was passed by Hitler and broadcast at 8 p.m. In it, the party officially announced that Hess had taken off from Augsburg in an aircraft in a hallucinated state, and not been seen since. It is to be feared that the party member Hess has crashed or met with an accident somewhere. Hitler noted Huell was now somewhat less tense and more lively. Hours passed, and then the BBC finally stirred. Rudolf Hess had landed by parachute in Scotland two nights before. The tension at the Berghof relaxed. Indeed, a mood of hilarity took its place. "Führer wants to wait until the morrow." Huell ended that day's momentous entries. The party had already begun in an anguished investigation into the deputy Führer's defection. On May 13th, the party circulated a second communique. Papers left behind by Hess, who was more familiar with the Führer's genuine peace proposals than any other person, suggested that he suffered from the delusion that if he took some personal step with Englishmen known to him from earlier times, he might yet manage to bring about an entente between Germany and Britain. In fact, Hitler's anger was immense. Hans Frank summoned post-haste to the Berghof along with all the other party leaders and Gauleiters who had been through many crises with Hitler and his personal lawyer, found him more upset than he had ever seen him since the death of his niece Gaily Rabl. In time, Hitler's anger softened. Schaub later wrote, "In later years, Hitler seldom mentioned Hess, but when he did, it was always to emphasize how highly he esteemed him. He had always been an upright and honest man until he was led astray." The Gestapo arrested the rest of Hess's private staff and questioned them. The dossier of interrogation reports missing for over 50 years surfaced in California in 1998. In January 1941, testified Gunther Soroff, Hess had once casually asked him to find out whether the British General Hamilton was still alive. He had already made one serious attempt to fly to Britain on January 10th, taking off from Augsburg at 3 p.m. in the specially adapted ME-110. Before leaving the administration building for his solo adventure, Hess had asked for paper to write something, and after his departure, the valet had handed to Adjutant Pinch a bulky envelope. As he read the contents, Pinch purpled and announced that their chief had flown to England. But at that moment, the control tower announced that the ME-110 was back and circling overhead. Hess had then had to use up 90 minutes fuel before he could safely land. He explained that the rudder was faulty. Pinch swore the others to secrecy. His conscience troubled, his detective Lutz had asked Pinch if the Fuhrer knew what was going on, as he would have to make some kind of report to Himmler. 2 or 3 days later, Pinch replied that Hess had assured him that he was calling off the flights for the time being. There were no more visits to Augsburg until March. Hess's staff had remained uneasy, his valet blurted out about what he knew of their boss's plan to the startled Adjutant Alfred Leitgen in mid-January, and suggested they mention it to Martin Bormann. But nobody wanted to volunteer for this duty, as nobody was certain whether the Fuhrer had ordered this secret mission or not. Lutz pressed Pinch several times about this. Lutz told the Gestapo interrogators on May 18th, the comrade Hess had apparently talked with the Fuhrer about such a plan while in Berlin on May 3rd to 4th. There was accordingly no need for me to report to the Reichsfuhrer SS. Lutz comfortably decided that Hess must have informed the Fuhrer of this plan. It all hinged on that furtive meeting between Hitler and Hess on May 3rd, 1941, just before the Reichstag speech, which Hitler had amended in one crucial passage in the strength of the message the younger Haushofer had brought from Portugal. Afterward, Hess had directed Pinch to have the Hitler speech printed in English, and he packed several copies of the translation, freshly printed in a very small typeface, into his luggage. Driver Lippert testified that a few hours after the Reichstag session on May 4th, Hess ordered his surprised staff to get ready for an immediate rail trip down to Augsburg. A special sleeping car was attached to the overnight Munich Express, and at 5:10 p.m., Hess left Berlin. Over lunch in Munich the next day, on May 5th, Hess had met the younger Haushofer at the Hotel Dreimohren, obviously to weigh with him the latest message from Portugal. They spoke privately, and Hess decided to fly to Scotland that same night. The ME-110 was tanked up, and at 4 p.m., Hess drove over to the Messerschmitt Field at Augsburg for the first time. He was wearing the new Luftwaffe uniform under his leather flying suit. He allowed Detective Lutz to take a roll of Leica snapshots of him in this unusual garb, in a room of the Messerschmitt building. When his driver asked about the uniform, Hess had told him not to breathe a word about it. "I'm planning a little surprise," he explained to his staff. Taking a handful of the Hitler speeches, a picture of his baby boy, but no hand luggage in order to save weight, he climbed into the plane and took off at 5:15 p.m., heading north. The flight was again a fiasco. An hour after his ME-110 reappeared over the airfield, circling to lose fuel, a radio fault had forced his return. On the drive back to Munich, his valet noticed that Hess was in a sour mood. Jeez, he did this so many times and they never got... Ugh. On the morning of May 10th, Hess directed Pinch to phone a meteorologist to get the cloud base levels over Scotland. The adjutant then phoned the Reich Air Ministry and asked them to switch on a certain radio beacon, Electra. Hess had meanwhile instructed his staff to keep their eyes open for a letter from his aunt in Zurich. Later that morning, May 10th, a letter did arrive from her for Hess. She reminded him that he had phoned her to look out for a certain letter from the International Red Cross, but reported that none had yet come. By then, however, he had already left on his adventure. This time, Hess forbade Lutz to take photos, saying it was a flying superstition not to be photographed before a long flight. He slung his own Leica camera around his neck. Pinch handed him maps and the envelope containing the Hitler speeches, and at 5:42 p.m., the ME-110 took off again heading north. This time, it did not reappear. At 9:45 p.m., Pinch revealed to his colleagues, "No phone calls have come, so Comrade Hess's flight must have succeeded." He pulled out of his attaché case a package containing a route map. It ended somewhere in Scotland, where Hess intended to parachute into the Hamilton estate, and several letters addressed either in Hess's handwriting or in typescript to the Führer, Himmler, a Messerschmitt director, and family members. Deciding that it was too late to disturb the Führer with this all now, Pinch waited overnight, then took the 7:35 a.m. slow train from Munich to Berchtesgaden. Upon leaving them, he told his colleagues that he hoped the Führer was not going to be too upset. This was the first alarming intimation that they had that Hitler might have been in the dark after all. All of that was now history. There were many who believed that Martin Bormann was morally to blame for Hess's flight, that he had undermined Hess's position so much that the minister had felt compelled to undertake this drastic act to restore his faded status with Hitler. When Goering asked Hitler whether he proposed to appoint Bormann as Hess's successor, the Führer shook his head and said that he had earmarked Bormann to succeed the party treasurer Franz Xaver Schwartz. The Reichsmarshal replied succinctly that Hitler was wrong by a long shot if he thought that would slake Bormann's ambition. "I care nothing about his ambition," retorted Hitler. Bormann would continue as head of the party chancellery. Goering was to look for a suitably youthful candidate to be party minister. On May 13th, 1941, the Berghof was packed with the party leaders and Gauleiters. From 4 until 6:30, Bormann and Hitler spoke to them about the Hess affair. It was now known, he said, that Hess had been manipulated by various astrologers, mind readers, and nature healers. Hewell later described the scene in his diary. Bormann reads out the letters left by Hess, a dramatic assembly heavy with emotion. The Führer comes, speaks very humanly, analyzes Hess's act for what it is, and proves he was deranged from his lack of logic. Excuse me. The idea of landing near a castle he has never seen, and whose owner, Hamilton, is not even there, etc. And Hore is in Madrid. And there's an asterisk. Sir Samuel Hore was the British ambassador in Madrid. Hess had in fact succeeded in navigating the gathering darkness to within 12 miles of his target, had then parachuted safely, no mean feat for a man of 47 on his first attempt, and was actually in conversation with the Duke of Hamilton within a matter of hours. Hess stated that he had come as a parliamentaire, unarmed, and of his own free will. Churchill ordered his incarceration for the rest of the war. Back up. Then from foreign affairs standpoint, and finally the domestic repercussions. A deeply moving demonstration, sympathy from the Gauleiters. Nothing is spared our Führer. Afterward, lengthy discussions. Hill continued that the Führer was relieved that he no longer had a formal deputy. After he had finished speaking, Hitler leaned back on the big marble table, with 60 or 70 Gauleiters and others pressed around him in a silent semicircle. He caught sight of Gauleiter Ernst Bolle, the Bradford-born Gauleiter of all Germans abroad, and asked him pointedly, "Tell me what you knew of the affair." Bolle guiltily replied that in October Rudolf Hess had sworn him to secrecy and asked him to translate into English a letter he was writing to the Duke of Hamilton. On no account was he to tell Ribbentrop about it. At this point, Hitler took Bolle aside, showed him the letters Hess had left, and asked him to point out paragraph by paragraph which passages had been in the letter Hess carried to the Duke of Hamilton. Shown the same letters with their occultist claptrap, Goebbels swooned with rage. "That's the kind of men we have ruling Germany," he wrote. "The whole business is explicable only in the light of this nature-healing and herb-munching foibles." His nature-healing and herb-munching foibles. Victor Lutze agreed, warning Goebbels as they drove to the local airfield afterward, that the public were bound to start asking how sick men could have held sway at the highest level of government. Albrecht Haushofer, Hess's young fellow conspirator, joined Hess's two adjutants, Pinch and Leitgen, in a concentration camp. Hitler intervened on behalf of Frau Ilse Hess, but Bormann, now all-powerful, had his own children, Rudolf and Ilse, rechristened, and ordered his former superior's name to be expunged from the history books. Woe betide those who fell foul of Hess's dynamic successor. Precisely 1 year later, on May 13, 1942, party headquarters in Munich telephoned Bormann that the obstreperous Gauleiter Karl Rover of Oldenburg was going the way Hess had gone. Following visits by faith healers and hallucinations, Rover had that day announced his intention of flying to see Churchill, after first calling at the Führer's headquarters. "As the whole world is mad." By that afternoon, Bormann's agents were already on their way to him, armed with top-level instructions. 2 days later, Rover had died a timely death. Hitler could order a state funeral, and Goebbels could sigh in his diary, "There goes one more member of the old guard. Euthanasia had its uses." On May 12, "euthanasia had its uses" was not a Goebbels quote, I don't think. It ends before that one. On May 12, 1941, Hitler formally replaced Hess's old office of the Deputy Führer with a party chancellery headed by Bormann. Bormann now gathered powers like the of which Hess had never had, but Hitler begrudged this hard-working, unobtrusive, ruthless manager none of them. Secretary Christa Schroeder overheard him command Bormann, "Just keep the Gauleiters off my back." And the 40-year-old Bormann, who in 1930 had founded the party's financial fortunes by an insurance scheme under which millions of SA street fighters had paid 30 pfennigs monthly and stuck stamps onto a yellow card, did just that. In alliance with the crafty constitutional expert Dr. Hans Lammers, Bormann established a civilian bottleneck through which all state affairs now had to pass on their way up to Hitler. Hitler's whim, no sooner spoken, was noted down by Bormann, elaborated by the lawyers on his staff, and circulated by party channels and teleprinters almost instantly as a Führer command. From now on, Bormann increasingly ran the Reich while Hitler directed his war. Bormann achieved that most dangerous of attributes, indispensability. Hitler ignored the man's boorishness. Bormann's one and only public speech at a Gauleiter conference was a fiasco. Privately, Hitler could never forgive him for what he and the party had done to his Obersalzberg. The Berghof was ringed by more and more buildings and construction sites and bunkers. He even mentioned to Schaub that he was thinking of moving his permanent residence to Linz or Bayreuth because of this. Hitler also disagreed with Bormann's brutal approach to dealing with the church and Jews. Yet Bormann survived until the end, dreaming of the day when he might step into the Führer's shoes. Bormann clung to him like ivy around the oak, Robert Ley was to say, using him to get to the light and to the very summit. For Hitler, the Hess case was already closed. His eyes reverted to the East. The 2nd Air Force had already begun uprooting its ground organization in the West. By the end of May, only a large radio deception organization would remain to deceive the enemy. Barbarossa was to be disguised as a master deception plan. The closer the date of the attack approaches, directed the OKW, the cruder will be the means of deception we can employ, in the intelligence channels as well. The airborne invasion of Crete was to be referred to openly as a dress rehearsal for the invasion of Britain, and several ministries were instructed to start planning for the occupation of Britain immediately. It was also time to start putting out cautious feelers to Russia's other bruised Western neighbors. There were military reasons why Finland must be approached now. In view of Finland's casualties in her recent war with the Soviet Union, no heavy burden would be foisted onto her. It would be left to her to decide how to meet the German requests. The course of this punitive war will definitely be as follows, Finland was to be told. After Russia has lost a certain area on account of the participation of many small nations, a crusade against Bolshevism, and in particular on account of the German Wehrmacht superiority, she will be unable to fight on. Hill's diary of May 15th notes, large quote coming up here. After lunch, the chief Ribbentrop comes with Dr. Julius Schnurr up the mountain. Schnurr is given instructions on discussing Russian problem in Finland and negotiating with Ritti, the Finnish president. He wanted to return via Stockholm, but the Führer is very hostile towards Sweden, says their ruling class is basically pro-British. If they did show any interest in Barbarossa, then it would be only so they could immediately report what they heard to Britain. Even the Reichsmarshal Goering has been cured of his infatuation for Sweden. Sweden would willingly sacrifice Finland if Germany lost the war. She is afraid of losing her dominant position in Scandinavia. Not anymore. On May 19th, Hitler was relaxed and even found words of approval for Italy. It is quite clear that the Duce is one of the greatest men in modern history, he told Hill. What he has extracted from the Italian people is quite marvelous. If he did not get any further, it was simply because he had reached the extreme limit of their capabilities. After him, there will not be another with his energy and talents for a long time. On the following morning, May 20th, as Goering's paratroops began their costly assault on the Isle of Crete, Hitler drove down to Munich for 2 days in the quiet seclusion of his apartment there. Anxieties gnawed within him as he pored over the charts of Europe. Earlier in May, he had feared the British might invade Portugal or Spain. He briefly received the Spanish ambassador and warned him of the British activities in Morocco, and told him of Abwehr reports on British plans to invade the Iberian Peninsula. Later in May, his anxieties concerned Barbarossa. Was the Eastern Front not suspiciously quiet now? The OKW circulated to the operations staffs a succinct warning. The Führer again reminds you that over the coming weeks, Russian preventive measures are possible. Grand Admiral Raeder came to see him on May 22nd. He casually mentioned the Bismarck and Prince Eugen had just sailed for their first sweep into the North Atlantic. Hitler remembered all the premonitions that he had only half-voiced in his private talk with Admiral Lütjens aboard the battleship at Gotenhafen. According to Hitler's naval adjutant, another factor in his anxiety was the wish to deprive Roosevelt of any justification for war, at any rate as yet. He mentioned to Raeder Lütjens' own reservations about enemy torpedo aircraft and asked Raeder outright, "Herr Grossadmiral, can't we fetch the ships back?" Raeder advised him that enormous preparations had been made for this sortie. To recall the warships now would have a catastrophic effect on naval morale. His policy of non-aggravation toward the United States did meantime bear fruit. The German Admiralty grudgingly conceded that his policy thus far seemed justified, but the restrictions that he continued to impose on the hard-pressed U-boat crews in the North and South Atlantic irked nonetheless. They were not permitted to attack American warships or merchant ships, nor to board those suspected of carrying war goods to the enemy, nor to use their armament even if the Americans were flagrantly violating their neutrality, unless the Americans fired the first shot. Hill's diary of May 22nd illustrates Hitler's dilemma over the United States. The Führer still vacillates in his attitude towards America, as you cannot peer into Roosevelt's mind. If he wants a war, he will always find the means, even if legally we are in the right. Japan holds the key. Even though he has still not made his mind up, it is better to keep the USA out of the war than perhaps to sink a few hundred thousand more tons of shipping. Without the USA, the war will be over this year. With the USA, it will go on for long years to come. A warning is agreed on. T. Got a date for Kudahy. John Kudahy, Roosevelt's former ambassador in Brussels, was brought up to the Berghof next afternoon to interview Hitler for the American press. Hitler's responses were short-tempered and impatient. Right at the start, he tried to put out of his visitor's mind the ludicrous notion that the Nazis might ever invade the Americas. This was just a wicked lie invented to convert American public opinion, said Hitler. Indeed, he laughed out loud, dismissed it as a childish suggestion, and exclaimed, "That is on a level with claiming that America plans to conquer the moon." Mindful of the propaganda designed to distract attention from Barbarossa, Hitler added that his OKW was not planning expeditions to the moon, but was busy with projects of rather shorter range, like Crete at a range of 60 miles, or Britain at a range of only 20. Hitler wrote afterward, "Questions from another world, childish like in the years of struggle 20 years ago, but positive." Kudahy deeply impressed. After Raeder's visit, Hitler had been distracted by a domestic incident from following Bismarck's steady progress toward the Americas too closely. A drunken remark made by one of Dr. Goebbels' senior officials, Professor Karl Böhmer, at a Bulgarian legation reception in mid-May, threatened to betray the Barbarossa operation. "In 4 weeks, the Russians will be finished," Böhmer had said. "Rosenberg's going to be Governor General of Russia." From the intercepts that resulted, Hitler found out about the incident and ordered an investigation. Hitler wanted Böhmer's blood and ordered him tried by the People's Court. "From now on, I will take ruthless action against everybody who can't hold his tongue." Late on May 24th, Raeder telephoned from Berlin with brilliant news. Bismarck had stumbled on two British battleships sent to intercept her. She had dispatched Hood, Churchill's most powerful battlecruiser, in less than 5 minutes. The British battleship Prince of Wales had suffered heavy damage and turned away. There was bad news, too. Bismarck herself had been hit twice, and she was bleeding oil. Her speed was reduced, and Admiral Lutyens could not shake off the pursuing enemy warships. Lutyens had suggested that Dönitz marshal all available submarines in one area, through which he would try to lure the enemy, but next day he announced that his oil was too low, that he must steer directly for Saint-Nazaire. That evening, Lutyens reported the first airstrikes, so the British aircraft carrier Ark Royal was clearly now within range. At Hitler's Berghof, Hill noted, "frightening hours on Bismarck's account." By noon, the 25th, Lutyens had at last managed to shake off his pursuers, but for how long? Goering ordered his commanders to push out air cover as far as possible toward the limping battleship. Hitler grimly radioed Lutyens greetings on his birthday. The mood at the Berghof was further soured by the presence of Heydrich and Goebbels, both loudly wrangling over the Böhmer affair. When Hitler rose on the 26th, the news awaiting him was that Bismarck had been found again by the enemy. Shadowed by an enemy aircraft, she still had 600 miles to go to Brest. Soon after 9 p.m., Lutyens radioed that the British aircraft had scored torpedo hits amidships and astern, and at 9:50 came the dread news that the battleship's steering was out of action. The unsinkable Bismarck was afloat, and her guns were primed. But at best she could only steer a slow and stately circle while the British battle fleet closed in. Shortly before midnight, Lutyens radioed, "Ship unmaneuverable. We are fighting to the last shell. Long live the Führer." To Hitler himself he signaled, "We shall fight to the end, and trusting in you, mein Führer, and with our faith in Germany's victory undestroyed." Hitler instructed the Admiralty to reply, "All Germany is with you. What can be done shall be done. The way you do your duty will strengthen our nation in its fight for survival. Adolf Hitler." During the early hours of May 27th, the Luftwaffe scoured the area. Ocean-going tugs put to sea. The Spanish government was asked to send out rescue ships. Lutyens' last radio message had come in at 6:25 a.m. Position unchanged. Wind strength 8 to 9. From then onward, there was silence. A funereal gloom descended over the Berghof. At noon, Hitler learned that the British government had announced the sinking of Bismarck an hour before. Disabled, and her last ammunition spent, Bismarck had scuttled herself under the guns of the British Navy. She sank with her colors honorably flying and the loss of some 2,100 lives. Hitler instructed that no battleship cruiser was ever again put to sea without his previous consent. Hill wrote on May 27th, "Führer melancholy beyond words. Uncontrollable fury at the naval staff. 1. The ship should never have been sent out raiding. 2. After finishing off Hood, she should have dealt with Prince of Wales, too, and not run away. 3. She should have returned straight to Norway and not run straight into the lion's den. Red tape and obstinacy in the Navy. We won't tolerate any man with a mind of his own. Reich foreign minister comes in the afternoon. Führer speaks his mind to him, swears and curses, and then calms down. A walk to the tea house. The Führer picks up again, talks about new types of ships and the airborne torpedo as a weapon." Raeder answered Hitler's criticisms soberly when he next came to the Berghof. He particularly emphasized that for Bismarck to have returned through the northern passages to Norway would have been more risky than continuing into the Atlantic. Hitler asked the Admiralty to adopt a policy of conversation of strength until the effect of Barbarossa on Britain was known. Should Britain's collapse threaten to become imminent, some very important duties might present themselves to our surface warships. Bismarck's loss had not been in vain. She had drawn off 5 battleships, 2 aircraft carriers, 3 battlecruisers, 11 cruisers, and 21 destroyers, which ensured the successful conclusion of the invasion of Crete, and the capture of Crete in turn reduced Britain's naval influence in the Mediterranean and paved the way for Rommel's triumphs in North Africa. Hitler, meanwhile, had issued a belated OKW directive ordering support for the Arab Liberation Movement against Britain. Jodl's chief assistant, General Walter Varlamont, had been sent to Paris a week to resume the military talks broken off in December, and a protocol had been signed granting the French certain concessions in return for assistance in Syria and Iraq, as well as the future use of the Tunisian port of Bizerta to supply Rommel's troops in North Africa. More reluctantly, the French agreed on principle to let Hitler operate their port at Dakar as a submarine and Luftwaffe base on the west coast of Africa. They also secretly agreed to remove General Weygand from his command, though this was not specifically mentioned in the protocol. It was signed in Paris on the 28th, and the next day, Varlamont flew to the Berghof to report. Events in Iraq were overtaking Hitler, however. The British were already advancing on Baghdad, and the end could not be far off, he said. The Middle East by itself would have been no problem if our other plans, meaning Barbarossa, were not irrevocable. I always have trouble with that word. When they succeed, we can open a door into the Middle East from there. Mussolini was opposed to abandoning the Iraqi rebels, and sent word to Hitler thus: "I, Mussolini, am in favor of active support, as this is an opportunity to raise the entire population of the Middle East against Britain. But if Iraq collapses, they will lose all heart. They will all lose heart again. If the German High Command also decides on active support, then it seems to me necessary to occupy Cyprus as well, after the reduction of Crete and Rhodes, since it lies off the Syrian coastline and holds the key to the entire Middle East." Hitler's first reaction was an outburst. "Mussolini thinks Cyprus should be taken now as well," and Hill recorded, "The Führer proposes to agree and to tell him to do it himself." Hitler did nonetheless ask Goering and Jeschenik whether Cyprus would be possible. The Reichsmarshal winced, reported on the blood the Luftwaffe had lost over Crete, 150 Junkers, 52 transports alone, and advised against invading Cyprus. "Since war broke out, the Luftwaffe has known no rest," said Goering. "From Crete, we shall now be fighting a pitched battle against the British fleet and Tobruk." Hill made a lengthy record of Hitler's worried conference with Ribbentrop and the OKW generals on May 29th, and it's as follows. The point under debate is how far to bring in France or to get her involved in the war with Britain. The Führer curses the Italians. He hates the Spanish. Of Italy, he says that you can't keep making concessions to somebody who is always running around with his backside black and blue from beatings, nor will the German people stand for it. The Führer's view is that when Barbarossa is over, he won't need to pay any more attention to Italy. We shall then automatically be able to come together with the French. They are counting on kicking the Italians out of Tunisia after the war. He wants to have a talk with Mussolini shortly. That's it. Later that day, the foreign ministry's Dr. Schnur briefed him fully on Finland and Sweden. The Finns had set up top generals to Germany to negotiate with the OKW and the general staff. They were asked to prepare two divisions to support Hitler's operations from northern Norway against North Russia. Barbarossa is a gamble, like everything else, said Hitler to Huell after Schnur left. If it fails, then it will all be over anyway. If it succeeds, it will have created a situation that will probably force Britain to make peace. When the first shot is fired, the world will hold its breath. And that's the end of the chapter.